This is Henrik. Welcome, guys and gals. Good to have you aboard today. This is Red Ice Radio. You can hear us on our main website, redice.tv, but we're also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, and of course on YouTube. And do make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel and click that alerts button or icon as well to get a notice when new content is up. We also, by the way, do live TV shows on the weekends exclusive at redicemembers.com. We also do other videos, live streams, and shorter video segments and interviews that also goes up to our YouTube channel, so heads up on that. We're also, by the way, in the process of producing more TV shows with additional hosts and other segments as well, so keep an eye on developments and updates, because much more is coming. Well, today we're speaking with writer Matt Battaglioli. He's the author of The Consequences of Equality. This is published by Arctos, but he's also written articles for Ludwig von Mises Institute, other libertarian, voluntarist, and some more ANCAP, anarchist, capitalist-leaning outlets as well. So thanks for coming on the show, Matt. It's good to have you here.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I'm really happy about it.
Excellent. So what do you think about the Trump effectively killing the TPP today with one of those executive orders?
I found out about that as soon as I got out of class, and I was like, oh, my God, this is fantastic. I was first shocked because this was a major campaign promise of Trump's. And honestly, I have such little faith in politics that I would have been surprised to have any campaign promises fulfilled by anybody. So just that alone was incredible for me. But I know I think it's great. I thought that the TPP was a really bad deal for the U.S. That was pretty bipartisan, actually, in my country. Very few people were really in favor of that, more so just lapdog politicians. We're actually in favor of that deal. So I think it's great that Trump killed that. I'm real happy about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he isn't a normal politician, which is one of the big advantages, of course, with him. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun, to be honest, because he's stirring the pot so much, and all these globalists and elitists and, career politicians, they have been butthurt about the ascendancy of Trump. And that alone has been like one of the reasons why I support him, because it's like, it's just fun to see some of these people squirm. You know what I mean?
It really is. It really is. He's also signed, one of his executive orders was a federal ban on more hiring.
Exactly, that's right.
Police. So that's really cool, too. I think that's long overdue. There's so many bureaucrats, we don't need any more of them.
So what do you know about what the ANCAP kind of crowd, the voluntarist crowd, think about Trump? I haven't really tapped into them to see where they stand on Trump. But generally, would you say there's a consensus there about him?
There's a split. You're going to find two groups in the ANCAP voluntarist group. The first, and that's probably the most prominent one that comes out of the Libertarian Party, all that kind of stuff. They are going to be your purists. They're going to say no politics, don't want anything to do with this. No one's better than anybody else. And it's almost self-defeating, that perspective, because if you're going to say anything short of waking up in ANCAPistan tomorrow morning is a failure, then you really can't have much of an opinion on anything because anything is just relative to something else. Now, there is a wing of more, I would say, sensible ANCAP voluntarists, and they are very excited about Trump's administration. They think he's hugely preferable to Hillary Clinton. They think that he's going to do some good things. And while still maintaining reservations about the man, they see this move against globalism with things like Trump and Brexit and, things of that nature being very healthy, very good for their cause, very good ideologically. So it really just depends on where you're going to look.
ANCAPistan, I like that. I gotta take that one.
Yeah, that's what we call it.
Yeah. Well, it would be some kind of stand if they don't put down their foot and say no to forced immigration,
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And typically, as you might expect, to that pro-Trump, anti-globalist, actually having an opinion crowd, they are also more conservative on cultural topics and more concerned about those things as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's get into the book a bit. I want to hear, I guess, some of the background to how you came writing the book. Again, the title is The Consequences of Equality. There's a lot of things here, of course, we can break down and that we should discuss. But how did you kind of get interested in the issue of egalitarianism?
Well, I'm an American college student, first of all.
that should do it, yeah.
Yeah, that really seems like, if you're on the right and you're in pretty much most universities these days, there seems to be this overwhelming infatuation with egalitarian desires. And I remember, actually, I can tell you exactly when I decided I was going to write that book. I was sitting in my sociology class, and the class hadn't started yet. It was going to wait maybe about 5 minutes. Two students behind me, they were having a talk, and I interjected into the talk. And I said to them, like, well, it was obviously, some political thing in sociology about some topic that we were discussing about how groups have a larger than usual in the Western Hemisphere income inequality. You know, typical talking point of the left, right? I was like, well, you know, that inequality isn't necessarily a bad thing. I just, you know, I think a pretty moderate position, pretty sensible one. And this one lady just goes back in her chair almost like her eyes roll back. She's like, you don't believe in equality? And I was like, well, no, I don't think I do. So I went home and I was like, I'm going to write a book about this. And I did. And that's what it is.
So how did this issue, as you see it, nestle its way into the West and get such a permanent staple part of how we're brought up and that kind of cultural framework do we have today?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of it, I think, really has to do with the transition that the world underwent towards the end of World War I from the monarchical kind of states to the democratic states. Because democratic states are typically very egalitarian. You know, they have that whole one person, one vote thing. They're much more prone to socialistic policies, also egalitarian. And then people grow up under these things. They're told that these things are very positive. They're told that the promotion of equality is a major asset to these sort of institutions. And it just becomes ingrained to us, almost as if we're hardwired from birth to believe in these sorts of things, whether they're good or bad.
Yeah, I've always seen equality, and I think many people who studied this kind of stuff agree that it's kind of replaced a religious thought. It's filling a purpose that we have kind of turned our back on in the West, which is one of a supernatural, you know, something of a supernatural level to it. I think that people need something to believe in. They need some kind of faith, both to enforce, but also to kind of feel stable in the world. And I don't know if you agree, Matt, but I see definitely that equality, that the church of egalitarianism has taken over that role.
No, I do agree. And in my culture chapter two, the last big main chapter in my book, I talk about how it pervades social institutions in the form of art and music, such that, you know, in the Middle Ages, people wanted to paint religious artwork, right? That was a social infatuation. However, now we have this thing called modern art. And modern art, I believe, is the exact same effect being manifested via equality, right? It's egalitarian. Anybody can do it. There's no hierarchy to it. These sorts of things, I think they're pervasive and prevalent anywhere.
Absolutely. So tell us about the, this will be an oxymoron to most people, but the authoritarian nature of equality, because most people think that there couldn't be anything that's more, not only maybe voluntary, but also more obvious that this is the system that we want. But right. I think most people that have their eyes open today in the world, they can see that there is an enforcement of this system, which not only restricts freedom of speech and freedom of association, but there's many other issues to this. So tell us more about that and how you see authoritarianism being tied into this.
Well, it's as simple as people are inherently in any measurable way unequal to each other. So to have it as a value that they're all not going to be anymore, that they're all going to be equal in some respects that they otherwise would not be, like you said, it requires a sort of enforcement. And I go a step further and I say it requires so much enforcement that it almost turns out to be micromanagement of people's lives. Because, you know, you have a lot of people who are on the right, even at least the right in my country. I don't really know how it is in Europe, as well as you do, at least. But they have this doctrine of equality of opportunity, but not of outcome. But even that has a somewhat authoritarian means to it, because if you have an unequal outcome in some respects, say it's a financial outcome, well, all of a sudden now you've got an unequal opportunity for the next generation or those recipients of whatever excess outcome that person may have. So some way or somehow you're going to need some kind of tax or regulation, some sort of cracking of the whip, so to speak, to make it so that people are actually conforming to this egalitarian worldview.
You know, the first article of the Charter for Human Rights out of the UN, it says, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in spirit of brotherhood. So what about this issue of us being unequal from birth? That, I mean, obviously a similar thing is kind of weaved into the American Constitution, right? You know, that we're all born equal. And I just don't agree with that. I think that people are vastly different. I also think that that's ultimately our strength to a certain extent, meaning that we have a diversity of people that are capable of different things. And it also means, of course, that some people won't be as good as others. And I'm perfectly fine with that. I don't have.
I
know that some people are better at me at a lot of stuff, but it doesn't hurt me. But it doesn't seem to be kind of an understanding that most people have today. They literally think that even if you were born without legs and arms, you are still as equal as everyone else.
Right. That's definitely something you're going to see being very pervasive. Now, in the U.S. Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, the whole all men are created equal thing, that was actually influenced by John Locke. And John Locke did not mean that the way that most people today take it to mean. What he was trying to say is people are born without any sort of innate ideas, any sort of predispositions. Now, I disagree with that, too, but that's really not how it's interpreted anyway. That kind of an interpretation is much less volatile to liberty, I would say, than the one that is being taken out of it right now. So that's something that I think a lot of people really should just learn. But yeah, I'd also like to make a distinction between different and unequal. You know, I got two bottles of water made by two different companies, but I'm kind of indifferent about which one. Maybe I'll just pull whichever one's closest in the fridge. They're different, but they're, for all intents and purposes, they're the same to me. You know, they're equal as far as I'm concerned. But an inequality means that there's something that I can say is objectively better based on certain values. And this is really how human beings differ from each other in terms of an actual inequality, right? You can quantify people's intelligence. You can quantify height. You can quantify weight. You can even quantify talent in many ways. So these are things that people are not really accepting to the extent which they should. And from that, we're getting this sort of authoritarian, egalitarian obsession.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's run amok. It's not one that has like kind of stopped at trying to provide an equality of opportunity. I think what has happened now is I think that there's a recognition in the fact that nature hasn't created us equal, and therefore it is now government's role or human's role to balance out those inequalities, right? And that's why you see, I like to put it this way, if an alien came to planet Earth and you know, landed and observed everyday life in the state that we're in right now, they might be perceiving this that, you know, the dude who gets to park, you know, closest to the facilities that you need to use or whatever, the biggest spot or have the biggest bathroom or something like that. It was like, well, that's got to be the most valuable person in your society, right?
Sure.
See what I'm saying? It's like we've turned it around, and now it's almost a worship of maybe disability, and it's almost a desire to break down or hold back those to have an ability that extends above the rest. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. I see what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. The alien analogy is quite nice, by the way. I like that. people are also very resistant to really even acknowledging what I believe are perfectly evident inequalities. I mean, they're okay with the ones that are blatantly, patently obvious, right? So you look at the National Basketball Association, the NBA, you see there's a lot more tall people. Well, any idiot can, you know, pretty much figure out that if you're tall, you're going to be a better basketball player. But what they don't really see is intelligence. And more importantly, they don't see intelligence as being something that's biological. They don't see it as something that is somewhat ethnic. They don't see it as something that is differentiated between different groups of people and different individuals. So it's almost like a communistic approach to biology in a way. You know, the communist doctrine for economics to say that everyone's economic situation is the same. So if somebody is above or below somebody else, that must be the result of exploitation. Well, people sort of have taken that notion to human beings and biology and culture and all of these sorts of things that are a part of our everyday lives.
You know, one thing that scared me when I discovered this was actually on this issue of IQ and race and these kinds of things that I noticed that within the American, I think this is, you know, probably in other countries too now. But there's, for example, a Indian guy was actually a brother to the comedian to the Mindy or whatever her name is. I forget her name now, but he's an Indian guy. He did a test, kind of a prank of sorts. He went this left liberal way and he changed his, identity, right? So he was no longer an Indian. He was a African American, right? And so he changed his identity. And he joined some medical school or something, or he applied for medical school. And it turned out that when he changed his identity, he actually got into medical school because they had a lower number that African Americans needed than Indians or Caucasians or Asians and stuff like that, right? So you're having this mentality now encroaching into areas such as medicine or becoming a doctor, that you lower qualifications just because you belong to another race. I mean, isn't that kind of a slippery slope? And eventually, where will we be if that continues,
yeah,
that line of thinking?
Absolutely. I don't know how it is, again, in Europe, but here in the U.S., we actually have a word for that. It's called affirmative action.
Right.
And yeah, that's exactly what you described. And people are very aware of it. People are very, in most cases, supportive of it. And even some people on the right here are supportive of it to some extent, right? But it stems from this idea that, oh, well, everyone's really the same. So if there is a disproportionate amount of people accepted to this college, then there are that many people in the country of that race or you know, ethnicity, then that must be the result of some kind of discrimination. So therefore, we need to do things like lower the standards, or we need to set quotas. I mean, we have diversity quotas here, whereas you have to have a certain amount of people from a certain background working for your company or something like this, or attending your school, or, you know, something of that nature, just because of their background, just because of their race, just because of some sort of ascribed status that they're born into. And it's not a good thing. Not only is this very, very rarely, if ever, the result of discrimination, but when it's taken for granted, you're going to see people doing these sort of jobs, these high intellectual jobs that really, you know, they probably aren't really capable of doing, at least not as well as other people are, just because of their race.
Right. So what it means is that if there is a statistical error, if government looks at the situation and they say, well, this is the percentile of, you know, blacks in America. This is the percentile of Asians. This is the percentile of Caucasians, whites, whatever. Then they have a view that those numbers almost exactly should reflect. Well,
yeah.
Okay, well, we can actually get into an argument here whether they actually need to reflect exactly, because at this stage there's actually, you know, disincentives towards white people to keep them out of certain jobs and stuff like that. But that's a different issue. My main point, though, is that they see, just as you described, just to clarify that, they see that if there is a discrepancy in the numbers reflected in the population, then it's a systemic error and not one due to the fact that this group is either interested in this or they're just not as good at certain things, right?
And you almost need to be incapable of using your senses to come up with this at this point. I mean, I'm writing another book right now, by the way. I mean, I'm not very far along, but I'm going to talk a bunch more about this kind of stuff in this book. And I've been doing a lot of research into this around the world lately, and reading a lot and listening a lot to some talks on these topics. And I mean, you could really go on and on and on about the examples that everybody is more or less knowledgeable about, but simply choose to ignore the meaning of in respect to race, ability, and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one of the things that really has kicked off all of this stuff is the social justice warrior movement. It's been on the rise in the last, I mean, really intensely in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, maybe. If even that, I mean, it's something that's really just, it didn't come out of left field, pun intended, I guess, but it's been there festering for a long time, but they've gained a momentum now that we haven't really seen before, which is just amazing. And it seems, when I look at it, it just seems not only hysterical, it's dumb and silly, and it's actually very easy to make fun of a lot of these people.
Oh, yeah.
Yet at the same time, you know, Matt, this in many regards is kind of, though, the dictating wisdom, if you will, of the day. I mean, if you listen to celebrities and even politicians to adhere to a lot of this stuff, more or less the same words is coming out of their mouths as some of these SJWs, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the reason for that happening is largely due to our democratic process now in the West. You know, I mean, if you have enough people in a certain group, well, eventually the people who represent or make up the state are going to have to appeal to that group. And in order to appeal to that group, what do you have to do? You have to begin to sound like them, right? Or if you want someone to watch your movies, if you voted for Trump, people are going to boycott your movies. So, you know, you say other things and, you know, eventually it just feeds into itself and they start propagating and people listen, and it creates more and more of these nutjob SJWs.
Yeah, I listen to, speaking of which, I listened to Ashley Judd. I don't know if you saw that clip after, you know, during the Inauguration Day protests. And it was just, oh my God, it was like every word in the book that kept me thrown out was thrown out to demonize Trump and Trump supporters and everything else. What do you think of what you saw this last Friday and also the consequent Saturday. I mean, if you ask me, these people just look like whiny crybabies that can't accept the process of the election system in America, right?
Yeah, I actually I was at the inauguration in D.C. on Friday, so I got to see that kind of stuff firsthand. It was really something. Like I had never seen those sort of protests up close before. After Trump won, there was one in my hometown, but I was in Iceland at the time, so I was there. And yeah, it's definitely a kind of a like, what are you even protesting kind of thing, you know? And my biggest issue though with these protests, you know, people want to protest, go ahead, let them, but they're very destructive when they do it.
Oh, they're violent, like, as hell.
Yes, too. They're very violent. Yeah. These are not peaceful protesters here, which I think is a big issue. You know, you have people who are trying to run honest businesses. You have very, you know, good people in the streets who are becoming victims to these people because they simply don't care for the results of an election. And yeah, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, but I mean, that's not how we do our elections here. So that's kind of a moot point as far as I'm concerned. I think the whole thing is just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things to say about that. One, I think obviously the Electoral College is a way to basically just ensure that every state holds as much power as the other.
Right.
So it doesn't run away, despite the fact that you have more numerous, you know, states and even in the city areas and these kinds of things. And then, of course, on top of that, you have very possible the issue still of vote fraud. This is something, of course, that Trump raised initially. The Democrats put him down and thought it was ridiculous. Then when Trump won the electoral vote, then the Democrats started talking about vote fraud.
It's always situational, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's always situational. It's kind of funny,
actually. And then some people, of course, even argued that there was actually a lot of illegal immigrants that were voting, stuff like this, right? So, you know, who knows who actually won the popular vote, to be honest?
And even if every single vote that was counted is an honest vote in this election, you know, the margin by which Hillary Clinton won the popular vote is smaller than the margin by which she won the vote in California alone. And if you don't want California deciding the results of an election, you may say, oh, hey, well, that maybe this is a good idea that we have here. So that doesn't happen.
Yeah, the rest of America have a say, basically. That's
I can guarantee you if the situation was reversed, they would be telling everybody on the right, you know, shut up, quit your whining, you lost, all this kind of stuff. You know, it's just how it is, politics.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, one of the problems, too, is that everyone basically to the right of Bernie is more or less considered a Nazi these days. And you have these groups now, like Socialist Alternative. We actually did it. We did a coverage. We did a number of people around DC and other parts of America. They went out and they filmed for us. We did an episode, kind of a special report video about this. And it was a tremendous amount of just openly communist organizations that are starting to organize and rally many of these young people now. And when I look at what's happening in America, I not only see more comparisons to what we've had in Europe with our version of socialism there, but I even see like a rise of what I like to call the American Bolshevik. Mm-hmm. And I wonder where this will go, because as we've talked about now, these people are not only intolerant, they are violent in order to get what they want. And so what do you think is going to be the next level to this? If we have 4 years of Trump, these people are not going to back down. They're not going to stop. There's going to be a tremendous polarization in America, I think.
Yes, there absolutely is going to be a tremendous polarization. And I don't know the extent to which our political system can sustain that. The last time we had a huge polarization, we ended up with the war between the states. That was quite a long time ago. Things are very different now. So I'm not, it's hard for me to say, especially me. I'm only 22 years old. I don't know if I've seen enough to be able to answer this too accurately. But I do think that the people in my country, at least, are much less susceptible to these kinds of things than they are in Europe, culturally speaking, right? We have a culture of individualism. We have a culture of, you know, responsibility. So I feel like that alone may deter it. I think 4 years of Trump may actually even offset it, especially if people end up doing better under Trump. And I did read some research maybe about a week or two ago that Generation Z, the generation following, I think, the millennials, so people like me, are actually so far the most conservative generation since World War II. So maybe it could balance out that way, especially if they need jobs and, you know, a guy like Trump can get them for them or things like that. So it's hard to say, but I think it could turn out okay. But at the same time, I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually, because I've been thinking about that, too, that if the main kind of narrative that's run in media and politics and just mainstream pop culture in general, if that is what it is today, you would think that actually younger people would kind of want to rebel against that. It's something right. that I've always figured that we can use to our advantage of actually try to, you know, not only make fun of them in the way that the left made fun of the conservatives for about, you know, 30 years before they toppled them and won the culture war. But I very much see us in the same position right now. So you're saying to a certain extent that you're encouraged maybe over the fact that young people are kind of sick and tired of this kind of leftism that we've seen?
Yeah. Well, I think that the leftism that you're seeing now, at least the hardcore, like very far left social justice warrior stuff, I think that it is, I mean, I don't even want to say think. I mean, I acknowledge that it's authoritarian well in its own right. And if a younger generation doesn't want that sort of, I'll say, even oppression by the previous generations, well, then they may very well rebel against that kind of thing.
What do you think the response would be if this turns increasingly violent? Because obviously, the reason why I ask this question is because I think historically, this is a very interesting question, because this has happened before in history. And it's, of course, created a different kind of response. I'm not afraid of that response, to be honest, but there's a lot of people that are. But what it shows then would be that an authoritarian system that would rise out of a response to an authoritarian system would, of course, be something which is more understandable, if I put it that way. In other words, it wouldn't just show up out of the blue, but it shows up as a kind of a defense mechanism. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Right. I think that's something that definitely will happen. But could you just maybe repeat the like main question?
Well, yeah, it's just more of a kind of a philosophical issue about, you know, history and is history going to be starting to repeat itself in some way or some fashion? That I guess what I'm asking is that, do you think that you're also going to see a response maybe from the right, from the conservative movement in America, of trying to push back this authoritarianism that we see?
I think that we already are seeing that. You know, you have the alt-right kind of stuff going on now. That's a relatively new thing. In physics, right, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. I think that's perfectly true in politics, too. You know, the alt-right is the reaction to the hardcore left social justice warrior stuff. So I think the conservative movement or the right-wingers are going to be pushing back. I think they're going to be doing so even more. The only thing that really worries me right now terribly is, in my country, we've, over the past couple of decades, have concentrated a almost unintelligent amount of power in the federal state. So if they ever had a domestic emergency such as, you know, mass rioting, mass, severe situations of any kind, well, that sort of thing, I'm very skeptical of government. I feel like they could use that to sort of impose a more authoritarian state from the top down.
Oh, definitely. I mean, to a certain extent, that's what executive orders have been. And now, from my perspective, then when Trump is in, I see it as a good thing because, like, yeah, the kind of the dictatorial methods that Obama enforced with executive orders can now be used from a positive point of view in my mind anyway. Right. Like, yeah, it's just start building that wall, you know, stop and make sure their jobs remain in America and all this kind of stuff. But obviously you're right. We have to also recognize that, okay, well, if he goes out in 4 years, or let's say he get a two-term office and he comes out after 8 years, then, you know, you might have another guy in there or another crazy SJW lady or something, woman, that's going to push back even more, and they're going to use the executive orders to their advantage, and they're going to make it even more worse for the right. So it's always give and take, right? And what I'm not seeing right now is kind of a not that I'm lukewarm and just want to see a balance between two factions all the time, but I returned to that point that I'm seeing an increasing polarization, and I don't know a way out of that. That's what I'm saying. You know, as you say, it's like if you have a direction, if you have a political system and an ideology pulling in one direction, you are going to have a response. It's unavoidable, you know?
Yes, and it's very difficult in the United States, too, because a lot of this power comes from the executive branch. And in the executive branch, well, we do not have a single of our 27 constitutional amendments, not a single one deals with the president's power, which means theoretically the power that Barack Obama has had, or in the power that Donald Trump has, is equal to the power that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had, because there's been no expansion of that constitutionally speaking. Now, do they actually have that little? No, absolutely not. So this increase is not even enshrined legally. So it's very difficult to get around it, you see, because you can't legislate against it because it was never legislated to into existence in the first place.
Right, which is a way, of course, which I think the left, the Democratic Party, ultimately sought to circumvent the Constitution.
Right? Oh, yes. Absolutely, definitely.
And now it bites them in the ass when Trump gets in there and can use it against them, right?
Yeah, every time. It's always like that. Somebody wants a lot of power for the person that they like, but when, you know, someone they don't like, it's still there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, how would, I mean, in terms of what's happening right now, there's a lot of issues that we kind of spoke of already, things such as, you know, maybe open borders and endless immigration and these kinds of very socially, the things that lead to social upheaval. And what I've seen is a kind of a lack of a response from like the voluntarists and the ANCAPs and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. that they're not really equipped to maybe like deal with some of these situations. And a few even ignore the fact that these are actually enforcements by, also by government, in some cases, federal government. It's kind of what Obama tried to do with, you know, the HUD program of trying to find, quote, racist, you know, zip codes, meaning those areas that were too white, they have to have forced diversity put in them. They have to have Section 8 housing and these kinds of things. And that immediately you lose this kind of sense of freedom that America stood for at one point, and you lose the freedom of association and all these kinds of things. And I haven't really seen like a proper response from the ANCAP kind of group. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that. Now, I mean, there's a few exceptions. Check out Libertarian Alliance based out of England. They're very good on this topic. Things like the Property and Freedom Society, Hans Hermann Hoppe's conference in Turkey, they're very good on this as well. But for the most part, yes, the ANCAPs are trying to remain very, very objective. The word racist does have power over them for the most part. So, yes, it's sort of something where that group of people is, while they have very good policy prescriptions, they're not very good in terms of actually enacting them and how we're going to get here to there, or not really being all about things like economics or things about ethics, but really dealing with culture. They don't really deal with culture at all. And they need to be doing that, I think. I think it's perfectly reasonable to be an ANCAP and to be culturally conservative. I don't think that requires any kind of dirtying of the doctrine. But so many of them don't even want to go there. They don't want to look at differences between people. They just want to have this one rule for everything, and that doesn't really work, especially not in this situation.
You know, because fundamentally I agree with most of those people, and I think that I'm all for freedom of choice and freedom of speech and all these kinds of things. And why not? It's a very Western kind of idea, but that's my point. I think that much of this would actually work in a homogenous country. I mean, right. I come from Sweden, so things there have been very differently politically. We did actually have for a while a kind of a free market system prior to us going in completely for democratic socialism after World War II. And at that point, of course, the society was kind of reformed. It took it in a very different direction. We were still very successful economically speaking, but it was very, very restricted and everything was very, very much government owned. Nonetheless, despite the fact that was a very system that I don't like, it was much better than what it is today. Today, with completely open borders, with run amok immigration, the country has just transformed so radically in the last 20 years that it's practically unrecognizable. And I just don't see how those kinds of values, which are ultimately, I think, are tied to not only the culture, but maybe even ethnically tied to the people in a country, how those are going to be upheld when you have Muslims, for example, in the country, or people pushing for Sharia law and stuff like that, radicalization and things like this. I just don't see how that just, you know, everyone is free to do whatever they want is going to work in that kind of environment.
Yeah, I don't either. And this is something that the ANCAP voluntarist group is almost as guilty of as the left-wing social justice warrior group. And that is simply assuming that everybody is sort of a product of their environment, that, okay, if, you know, a group of Muslims who came from Afghanistan just immediately show up 100,000 of them in a Western European country, that, oh, well, they could just assimilate. We're all the same. That's just the background. That's environment. You know, don't fault them for it. But that's not true, right? And that's a concession that a lot of ANCAPs make that they really shouldn't make. And I personally believe that the state will destroy the nation. And that's exactly what's happening in a place like Sweden right now. It's exactly what's happening in my country right now. It's what's happening in a lot of Europe right now. So you can be, like I've said, an ANCAP. I think it's very logically consistent to be one and then still be culturally conservative, because as long as you have a state, you're going to see a group of people wanting to consolidate power. One way to do that is with multiculturalism. You lose your social adhesion. You lose a lot of very important social values, and people want more government when that happens. Government loves that. But to make these claims that a lot of ANCAPs make that, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, it's not working and it's inaccurate.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Well put. We've talked a bit about the authoritarian nature of equality, how that's kind of enforced and everything else. Let's talk about some of your other chapter headings that you have. So tell us about the economic consequences of equality.
Well, this is a rather extensive chapter. I think it's the longest one in the book. Well, the economics of equality, well, that manifests itself in, I believe, a few different policies. There are some obvious ones, right? So the more obvious ones are things like the progressive income tax, the inheritance tax, minimum wage laws, things like this that are inherently uneconomical, but at the same time promote sort of an egalitarian value. Now, there is one thing, and I would even point to it as being the single greatest negative policy, or the single greatest thing that should be destroyed in the West and really around the world that is necessary for an egalitarian society to exist. And that is a central bank with fiat money. That is, as a lot of people do not realize, very deeply egalitarian. And let me tell you why that's a very deeply egalitarian. You see, in order to have a equal society, what that means is certain people need to have, or excuse me, all people need to have access to the same things at the same quality, right? Socialized medicines, public schooling, public infrastructure, all of these kinds of things that need to be available the same way to everybody at the same time. Well, if something is a scarce good, which means you can privatize it, somebody can own it, that means that there is simply not enough of that thing for everybody to have as much as they want of that thing, right? You would not pay for oxygen. There's enough of it. Everybody can have as much as they want. It's not an issue. You would pay for anything. You'd go to the store for food, right? You'd pay for, carpeting for your room. You pay for, you know, a house, because those things are scarce. You can privatize them, own them. It's a good thing. Now, in order for the left to push this equal doctrine, they need to usurp that. They need to say, look, we're going to give you all the exact same thing. Everyone's going to be equally in on it. It's going to affect everybody the same way. But you can't really have that work, because if it can ever be owned in the first place, if it can be private, that means there must not be enough. And if there is not enough, how do they provide it to everybody? Well, they really can't. So what they do is they get the central bank and they take all hard money out of the equation. And they say, look, we can't afford this because there's not enough money, because money is just a representation of goods, right? A homogeneous representation for otherwise heterogeneous goods. And anybody who needs this, we're going to print more money for it. And we're going to print more money for it. And we're going to print more money for it. Until it eventually, you know, all the bad loans are cashed in and it liquidates and the whole thing collapses in on itself. That's called the Austrian business cycle theory. But fundamentally, for that to actually be put into practice, they need the central bank. They need fiat money. I'm sorry if that was a kind of a hasty, not very coherent explanation, but I hope you got the point.
No, I definitely follow that. I mean, we've been talking for years about, you know, how the world also walked away from the gold standard with the Bretton Woods Agreement and all these kinds of things. You had plans all the way back. I think it was back in 1913 that the Federal Reserve was set up in America too, or was it maybe 1917? I forget which year it was.
December of 1913.
1913, that's right. And they did it, of course, even on, I think it was Christmas Day or something like that.
It was right around Christmas.
Everyone was away, of course, and was slipped under the radar of most people. And I think also for the longest times, America didn't actually have any inflation because it was highly, controlled.
We had deflation for a little while, actually, which is great. I could go into these economic, I mean, that's my field is economics. So if I know anything about what I've written, then it's going to be that. But I think that when you have a central bank, when you have money, I go back to the history of money and we say, look, you got a rock, you want a stick. All right, we're going to trade those things. But not everybody wants a rock. Not everybody wants a stick. well, all right, so we come up with money. That, you know, that solves what's called the double coincidence of wants problem. But that doesn't mean that you can just have, you know, more money, that there is representation for other physical goods, right? Because that's going to be called inflation, because you're creating the money, but you're not creating the wealth to back it up. And if when somebody puts the money in the bank, what they're doing is they're saying, hey, I'm not going to consume any resources with this money. Somebody else can then say, hey, look, I am going to consume with this money. I want to borrow it. So they borrow it. And the more money there is, and the lower the interest rate, and the less money there is, the higher the interest rate. That's just supply and demand, right? The interest rate being the price of borrowing money. But if the central bank comes in and then puts more money in the bank that does not represent other goods and services, that means that you may have a situation where people are trying to consume with the same dollar, and there's not enough in the economy to satisfy both consumptions. It really screws up the equilibrium between consumers, investors, and savers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess today. And then, of course, on top of the different national central banks, you have things such as the Bank for International Settlements, you have the IMF, the World Bank, which just dictates to most of these central banks how to act and how to behave anyway. So, I mean, the issue of finance and money and everything has really left people's hands. I think if you go back to the Renaissance, they had, for example, two different currencies, one for trading, and when you actually purchased goods that needs to be spent right away, and they had another currency for when you actually need to save money and things like this, which seems to be much, much smarter, to be honest, to actually get people to spend on the things that are disposable, so to speak, and then they can save with other currency and stuff like that. So that's been controlled from day one. And I don't know if you know this, but actually most of the countries that has been, invaded and toppled in the last, 15 years, maybe even more now, 20 years, are those that initially didn't have a central bank. And then one of the first things that the powers that be did is to set up a central bank. Take Iraq, for example, or I think it was the same with Afghanistan.
I'm pretty sure it was the same with Afghanistan, actually. Yeah, I knew about Iraq, and I'm pretty confident about Afghanistan, too. But yeah, I was aware of that. It makes you wonder, is that intentional? And I think that it perfectly well is intentional. You know, there's so many people behind the scenes, so to speak, not to sound too conspiratorial or anything, but, things are what they are, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we don't shy away from that at all. Do you know much about BIS, Bank for International Settlements, and what they're up to and what they do and how they control and regulate things?
I know quite a bit about World Bank policy and IMF policy. I'm not as familiar with that one, though.
So tell us a bit about how you see the IMF influencing. They wield quite a bit of power, I guess, over central banks of different nations too, right?
Yeah, it's basically the central bank's central bank, as I understand it. So you can imagine that everything that you have an issue with the typical central bank, with the IMF, is going to be more or less doubled down. And there have even been some sort of talk about creating a global fiat currency through the IMF, which would just be a disaster. If that hyperinflated, we'd be back in the Bronze Age in no time. So I'm very skeptical of the organization. I think that the dictations that they give to regular central banks have been very disastrous for monetary policy around the world. Hyperinflation in some places, certainly strong inflation in other places. And they always seem to be up to something, too. You know, you can never really look at them and be like, all right, what are you guys doing now, and not find anything. They're always trying to get that world currency, and they want that. They need it. Because anywhere that there is some sort of independence, be it national independence or economic independence, well, that's a threat to some sort of, globalist agenda.
Yeah, what was that called? It was someone who pointed that out, that effectively we already had that. It's actually the currency that the IMF deals with. Was it scrips or something? What was it? Yeah, special drawing rights. That is SDRs, exactly. That's right. So that it's basically, that's the money, if you will, that they lend to countries or to other federal banks. So effectively, we already have that. It's just that, it's one of those things where it slipped under the radar. People didn't even realize that we had one.
Yeah, it's just not in our hands, but it's in the hands of the people that manipulate our central banks and give us money and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely crazy, So yeah, you have the IMF, you have special drawing rights, you have all these kinds of issues. Yeah, they wanted a stepping stone just for people too, though. I know that there was a talk a few years ago about the Amero, right, joining Canada, America, and Mexico. And that seems, I mean, I guess now with Trump, that's just at least, you know, that proposition has been, what would you call it, tabled. That's out of the window for at least for 4 years. We'll see what happens after that point. But
yeah, that's not going to go through.
I don't think so either. I don't see that. And again, for them to bring in a global currency for your average, you know, Joe to deal with, I guess something really, really radical economically has happened. And if we just for a moment talk about the American economy, there's been speculations about a crash for decades now, considering how much money that U.S. owns. I think that, what is it, up to $19 trillion now in debt?
Oh, it's almost $20 trillion. It may even be $20 trillion. It was 19.99 something last I checked, but
yeah,
that was a few days ago. I don't know. But yeah, it's a lot.
How is it sustainable? How is this system still holding up?
Central banking. That's really it.
So they print, but can they just go on and print forever? At some point, no. There has to be, you know,
eventually people are going to realize, look, you guys are just printing money, all right? And then that's called a debt default. There's only one time in the entire U.S. history where our debt matched what it is now, and it matches almost exactly in terms of debt to GDP. And that was right after World War II. But culturally, we're very different right now. And also, global banking institutions have gained quite a bit more power, and they have an interest in seeing these kinds of things not work out. In fact, even then, there was still some backing of hard money, right? There we had silver banknotes that could be used for money. So it was a little easier to work with monetarily than it is now. So in many, many ways, the situation now is worse, even though the debt-to-GDP ratio is about the same.
All right, well, Matt, in a little bit here, we're going to take a break and then continue and talk more about this and
sure.
Rest of your, some of the topics, of course, that you bring up in the book and much more. There's things I wanted to, you know, make part of the discussion here, which I think is interesting. But so where's the best place to go? I know, as you said, the Arctos. Arctos is the one who are printing the book. People can get it through there, but I believe it's also on Amazon. I don't know if you have a personal website where people can get the book or not.
I don't have a personal website. I'm going to wait. I am planning on having one of those at some point, but not immediately. You can get it, from Arctos. You can get it from Amazon. You can also get it from writeon.net, which is like some sort of partnership website with Arctos.
Absolutely. Very good. We'll have the links up to this, Matt, and people do check it out. It's called The Consequences of Equality. We're going to have links up to the book where you can get that, and we're going to continue to talk more with Matt in the second segment. So do stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back after the break. We'll talk to you on the other side.